This week's parsha is Parshas Vayechi, last parsha in the book of Bereishis. And I'm going to be focusing on the part of the parsha, but right as Jacob is about to pass on. Before he passes on, he gives each one of his children a blessing. He gives each one a blessing. Now, before he actually gives the blessing, he makes the following statement. You can see it on page 274 in the Hebrew, 275 in the English. Pasuk Aleph, Perek Mutas, Pasuk Aleph, chapter 49, verse 1. Vayikra Yaakov Albanav, and Yaakov called to his children, Vayomer, and he said, Hey Asfu Vagid Elochem, gather together and I will tell you, Eis Ashayikra Eschem Achris Hayomim, that which will befall you, that which will befall you in the end of days. So Rashi has a famous comment here that Yaakov really wanted to divulge to his children when the ultimate redemption will come, when the coming of Mashiach will come. But the divine presence left him at that point of time, and he realized that it was not meant for him to reveal that point of time when it would come. At the same time, the Medrash actually tells us that there was another message here that Yaakov was giving to his children, and that was Hey Asfu comes from the word Asof, to gather together. And the message of Yaakov by saying Hey Asfu, gather together, was really a message in which Yaakov was telling his children, do not have machloikis, do not have conflict, do not fight with each other, don't have strife with each other. That's what it means here. Hey Asfu, gather together, make sure that you are united, make sure that you are one together. And when you attain that oneness of being together, that is when you will have readied yourselves, prepared yourselves for the Geula, for the ultimate redemption with the coming of Mashiach. That was his message here. That was one of the messages here. Hey Asfu, gather together. Make yourselves one Asifa, one gathering. And once you make yourselves, as the Medrash says, Aguda Achas, one grouping, you're united as one, that is when you will be able to merit the ultimate Achras Hayamim, the ultimate end of days, which is the coming of Mashiach. Now, So here is already one message at this point of the parsha about the importance of unity, of that making sure that we all get along with each other properly, respect each other properly. And actually, Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal points out here in his commentary that Yaakov's message of being united was the following. You know, each one of them received a blessing. Each one received a blessing. Yehuda is the lion, which means he is going to eventually be the king. And Zevulun was the seafarer. He was the one who was going to travel the seas. He was going to make the livelihood and support those who study Torah. Each one of the blessings that were given to each one of these sons was actually not just a blessing, but a mission. It was the mission that each one of them, who were the ancestors of the tribes of Israel, each one of them, each one of their blessings, was actually each one's unique mission as part of the Jewish nation. The Jewish nation has 12 distinct parts. It has 12 tribes. Each one of the tribes has their unique mission to contribute and to create the entire body of the Jewish people. But each one has their unique mission. And often when people are doing things differently, you know, it could kind of lead to some strife. You know, I think my way is right, you think your way is right. And actually, if you just work with the simple explanation of the verse, Yaakov says, gather together and I will tell you. Which means that Yaakov had all of his sons there at the time when he blessed each one. That means Yaakov intended for each one to hear the blessing of the other one. That means that Yaakov intended that each one should hear each other's unique mission. You should hear it. You should respect it. You should appreciate it. Because you should know that not one of you alone can hold up the Jewish people. each one of you needs the other one to be able to have the complete body. And therefore, if you realize that, you appreciate that, and you remain united as one, then you have readied yourselves, you prepare yourself for the coming of Mashiach. Okay. Now, there is another interesting lesson about how we are to treat each other in this part of the parsha. But before I get to it, I want to kind of start with something else related. I have here in front of me a sefer from Rabbi Yitzchak Zilberstein, who is a rabbi in Bnei Brak and Eretz in Israel. And Rabbi Zilberstein was mentioning, I guess I don't know when he said this exactly, but I don't know if he related to this first, but here in the sefer, in the book, they related to a verse in this week's parsha. But he mentioned that there was once a rabbi in Smyrna, Turkey. And his name was, make sure I got his right name, Rabbi Chaim Palagi. Rabbi Chaim Palagi, Sephardic sage in Turkey. And actually, he wrote a sefer called Kaf HaChaim, which is a very famous book on Jewish law, on halacha. And the Kaf HaChaim used to tell people, an Erev Pesach, before Pesach, everybody's ready, it's all busy, cleaning the house, getting ready for the Seder. It's a very, very, very busy time. And it's a time that we celebrate our freedom. And it was at that point of time, Reb Chaim Palagi used to tell the people of his community that actually during this time of the celebration of freedom, we should be working very hard on the mitzvah called Pidyon Shvuyim. Pidyon Shvuyim means releasing people who are taken captive. The special mitzvah that if a fellow Jew has been taken captive, that we should work to release them. And I would think that now Reb Chaim Palagi was born in around the 1780s, and he died in 1850. And I'm assuming that he made this comment about that this time of that he was, you know, admonishing them that they should try to fulfill this mitzvah of freeing captives, because there was a problem during those times of people being imprisoned wrongly, being kidnapped, and basically, you know, you had to put together a certain amount of money, of ransom money, and you pay the ransom money, and the person went free. It's, you know, happens nowadays too. But in you know, I'm assuming that he mentioned this because it was a problem in Turkey in those times, and therefore his point was that in the time that we're all celebrating our freedom, we have to make sure that people are free. People who aren't free, we have to make sure and work to help them to become free. So Rabbi Zilberstein said that when he one time, you know, delivered this, told this over at a talk, so somebody got up and asked, you know, how nowadays can we do that? How nowadays can we fulfill this mitzvah? The truth is, sometimes it comes up, but it doesn't come up as much as it used to. There's not that many times that you have, you know, at least that we're aware of or we have access to, you know, fellow Jews who are kidnapped and they need to be freed. I mean, that's like it doesn't happen, but it's not as common as it used to be. It's not like in times where, you know, if somebody was in jail and you paid off the warden or the mayor or whoever was in charge, you paid them off, you can get the person free. You know, it just doesn't work that way so much anymore, at least in certain places. So you know, the person said, how can, you know, how nowadays do we have a chance to do this mitzvah? So Rabbi Zilberstein did not really have an exact answer, but he tried answering this person, so to speak, in being able to fulfill the idea of freeing a person from imprisonment in the spirit of it. And he brings down from a sefer called Ali Shur. Ali Shur was written by a rabbi Shlomo Volbe, who lived in Israel. He passed away, I don't remember exactly how many years ago. And he wrote in his sefer Ali Shur the following. And it's a loose translation that I'm going to be, he quotes it, but I'm giving you a loose translation. He talks about a person who has suffered some form of tragedy. A person who suffers some form of tragedy means that the Midas Hadin, Hashem's judgment, right, has been strict with that person, right? When Hashem decides how a person is going to go through life. So, thank God things go well, We attribute it to Hashem's mercy. We don't consider ourselves worthy. And then if things don't go so well, then that means Hashem decided that there's going to be a more stricter judgment with us than a merciful one. So he writes that a person who has experienced the attribute of strict judgment, whether it be illness, whether it be some other kind of tragedy or problem. So now, this person, Rabbi Volba writes, this person finds himself imprisoned. A person who is in a state of suffering is in a state where they are engulfed in a certain issue, in a certain problem, and not always are they able to get themselves out of it, especially in cases of illness. And they actually find themselves feeling very alone. When you suffer something, when you experience a certain tragedy, whatever it may be, there's a certain feeling like I'm caught inside this tragedy, and I'm like imprisoned in it, and I'm alone. You become very lonely. And perhaps, he says, the pain of the loneliness is even worse than the pain of the actual issue at hand. And the truth is, you know, when a person is living life as, you know, in a state of healthy and tranquility, when things are going regular, so in that situation, you know, part of the joy of life is the fact that whatever I'm doing it amongst others. I could be doing it with others. I'm functioning amongst others. And the fact that I have this, I'm accompanied by other people in my life, and what I'm doing brings a certain joy to life. But then a person could all of a sudden find themselves in this state where they're cut off. Now they're not able to function as they were. They're not able to function together with everyone as they were before. And that creates a certain feeling of being alone. Now, he gives certain examples. He says, you know, this kind of suffering that does this can do this at different levels. But, you know, he says there are certain times where people are, let's say, become limited in what they can do. They become limited. They become limited because of illness. They become limited because of age, whatever it may be. They become limited. And until now, they were able to function at a certain level and do everything that they wanted to do and they were used to doing. And now something happens. Perhaps they became ill, they became older, and they can't do what they wanted to do. And and that itself is painful when I can't do what I was able to do before. But it also now makes them feel separate. Because when they were functioning regularly, they were functioning again with everyone. And now they're stuck. They can't function like they were. They can't be active like they were. And they're not going to be active together in the way that they were before. Now, sometimes a person finds themselves in a state of being limited. They're limited. They're limited in what they were able to do physically. They were limited in what they're able to do spiritually. And that creates a certain sense of loneliness. How much more so, Revolver writes, when a person unfortunately is struck with a terrible illness, where they're basically suffering constantly in their illness, how much more is the loneliness involved in that a person becomes enveloped in? And the job of other people is to be able to pay attention to that person and to actually try to make the person feel that they're not alone. And the highest form of doing that, the highest form of not feeling alone, is when you show that person that you feel their pain, that you suffer with them. You basically imagine yourself in that person's shoes and you get yourself to a point that you are carrying it's called nosei ba'ol, you're carrying the load with that person. You're feeling their pain. And when the other person realizes that you're feeling their pain, they don't feel alone. And by not feeling alone, you've definitely have now lifted off from them a very big part of what they're suffering from. And the truth is that you know, a person who actually feels the suffering of others is actually emulating God. Because we have a tradition from the Talmud that it says, B'sha'a sha'ad mitzta'ar, the Gemara says, the Talmud says, when a person is suffering, Shechina ma'aloshin ameris. What does the divine presence say? The divine presence, the Talmud says, it cries out with the person. It suffers with the person. Hashem, so to speak, understands our pain, feels our pain, and so to speak, cries out with us. So when a person feels the pain of others, a person is emulating God. And Rav Zilberstein writes that, you know, it's not just when a person, you know, goes as far as really feeling someone else's pain, which is clearly the highest level to do, but just showing the person that you're paying attention to them. Somebody is paying attention to them. Somebody cares about them, which can sometimes be enough where you see a person who's really down or suffering, and you can't really do much more than smile at them, say hello to them, a nice good morning, a nice shalom aleichem, where again, you're not solving the problem, but you're breaking through the loneliness. You're showing the person that you care, that they mean something. You know, there was a story with Rav Avram Palm, the Shishiva of Yeshiva Tarav Adas, who, they tell a story, it's a story that happened to him, I'm sure to many people. Basically, a family was sitting Shiva, I think was over the loss of a child, and Rav Palm came in to pay a Shiva call. He just sat there, he didn't say a word. Didn't say a word. Sat there for whatever amount of time. He got up afterwards. He consoled them. He said, "Amokim menachem eschem," and he left. And the family said that they were so tremendously comforted from him, because whether he said something or not, they knew when he was there that he was feeling their pain with them. And that's a lot of times what a shiva call is about. Shiva call is not always about having to have a big conversation, but it's the fact that the person who is suffering, right, sees that someone's caring. Because it means that there is a certain degree of when we are suffering, how we kind of, again, we see ourselves kind of imprisoned, set aside, separated from everyone. And when others come and they show us that they care, in that situation, they're showing us that they're not alone. We're not alone. And when a person feels that they're not alone, that is when they have a certain degree of the burden is taken off from them. So his point, Rav Zilberstein's point was that, again, you could have a situation where you can't necessarily free a person from prison. The opportunity to do that may not be, but there is an emotional prison that a person can find themselves in. There are lonely people. There are people who are very lonely. And whether it be at a large scale, at a smaller scale, they're lonely, literally they're lonely because of the fact that they've been cut off from things, they feel cut off from things, due to the illness, due to whatever it may be. In spirit, when you go ahead and you show them that you care, that you're paying attention to them, you are to some degree freeing them from that emotional prison, from that prison of loneliness. That was his point. And that relates to the Parsha in the following way. If you take a look on page 278, which is Perek Memtes Pasuk Yud Beis, page 279, it will be chapter 49, verse 12. Chachlili einayim miyayin, red-eyed from wine, ulaven shinayim echalav, and white-toothed from milk. That last few words, ulaven shinayim echalav. Ulaven comes from the word lavan, which means white. Shinayim is teeth. Mechalav, chalav is milk. So the translation of the words are ulaven shinayim mechalav, white of teeth for milk. In the literal translation, it means that Judah would be blessed with land that would produce fine grapes for wine, and animals that would produce milk. And there's going to be so much of it, right, that the eyes are red from wine and the teeth are white from milk. That's the basic interpretation. But there's a midrashic interpretation, ulaven shinayim echalav, means the white of teeth mechalav more than milk. There's something that the whiteness of your teeth can do more than milk. Because whiteness of the teeth means that you're smiling at a person. So when you smile at a person and show them the whiteness of your teeth, you're doing more for them than giving them milk. As nourishing, as important as milk is health-wise, a smile gives you emotional health, which is even more important than giving them something to be physically healthy. And an example of, and this whole discussion that we gave is an example of that, where what you're doing, what you're showing a person, the friendship that you're showing the person is doing more for them, that is doing so much for them. As the pasuk says, more than giving a person milk for health is the emotional health that you give a person by giving them a smile or whatever other way that you're showing them that you care about them. Now, one other example that Rabbi Zilberstein gives, on this idea about the whiteness of teeth or what we do for a person, how much we can do, he cites the following story. And this is a story that I'm sure you've heard various forms of it all the time, but it's a story that shows that, you know, what one kind word or one kind compliment can do for a person. So Zilberstein brings a story about how there was this person who belonged to his shul who was approached by a rabbi in Bnei Brak, a rabbi who was very involved in people who had problems with their marriages. People who had problems with their marriages, they used to go to this rabbi for advice. He was very involved in helping people in difficult marriages. So this rabbi came over to this person, Rabbi Zilberstein Shul, and he told him, "You saved this and this family's marriage. You saved that marriage." So the person said, "You know, I'd love to say that compliment is true, but I, you know, you must be speaking to the wrong person. I'm not, you know, I have no idea what you're talking about." And he told him that, you know, it was a certain family, you saved their marriage. So what are you talking about? So he said to him, "Try to remember something. Do you remember a few weeks ago, or a few days ago, you noticed a young boy who was studying very, very diligently? His Torah study, he was doing it in a very, very diligent manner. We call that person a masmid. He was studying very diligently. And you were so impressed by him that you went over to his father and you told his father how fortunate he is to have such a wonderful son and how fortunate are parents to have such a wonderful... You've done such a wonderful job in raising your child to be such a diligent student." That's all he said. "So, do you remember saying that to this person?" And he said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, that compliment that you gave changed this person completely." Because very often, when there is a problem in a marriage, on the surface, the problem is they're not showing each other, they're not respecting each other. But the deeper issue may very well be that it's not, the deeper issue is not they're not respecting each other, it's really because they don't respect themselves. If a person has low self-esteem, they look down at themselves, then it's very hard for them to look positively at others. If a person has a proper self-esteem, if they look at themselves well, then they look at each other, others in a positive way also. When you went over to this man and you told him, you complimented about his son, you changed his whole view about himself. He changed about how he looked about himself. You raised up his self-esteem. And once he now looked at himself in a positive way, he was now able to walk into his house and have a completely different perception, a completely different view of his wife and his home." That's another example of, you know, just what the whitening of your teeth, one act of caring, one show of respect, one show of caring, what it can do to help another person. Now, the handout that I gave you is a shiur, an article regarding the mitzvah of the haftel reyacha kamayecha, love your friend as yourself, which clearly what we've been discussing falls, you know, under that mitzvah, as we'll see. And you know, this was something that I saw on Asarah B'Tevis, the 10th of Tevis, that was this past Tuesday, which commemorates the siege of Yerushalayim. And as we know, the second Beis Hamikdash, the second temple, was destroyed because of Sinas Chinam, because of the fact that we were not united, we weren't one with each other, we didn't treat each other properly. And therefore, the mitzvah of Ahavta L'Reacha Kamecha, the mitzvah of loving your friend as yourself, is definitely appropriate that we should have a chance to review some important principles about that. And as we've seen so far from what we discussed in the parsha, how much it relates to this week. So let's just quickly go through. This is a number of short, ideas about the mitzvah, but it's a nice, short, concise review of what we have to bear in mind in order to fulfill this mitzvah of love your friend as yourself. Okay? So the first paragraph begins the mitzvah. Okay? You want one?
No, just listen.
Okay. The mitzvah. Okay, so the first paragraph begins, it is a mitzvah incumbent upon every individual to love every member of Klal Yisrael, as it says, V'at l'riacha kamoicha, love your friend as yourself. Anything that you would want others to do for you in Torah and mitzvahs, you should do for them. Including in this are physical acts of gemilas chesed, acts of kindness, such as visiting the sick, comforting mourners, attending a funeral, bringing joy to a bride and groom, and helping other in all their needs. Meaning, what is the meaning of love your friend as yourself? What does that mean? What that means is that what you would want for yourself, you should want for others. If you're in need, you want others to help you, you should do the same for others. So whether it's in a physical sense, whether it's in a spiritual sense, whether it means a person is in need of some spiritual point. They need, as he's going to mention later, they need to study Torah, whatever it may be. Anything that you would want for yourself, you should want for others. And when you do that, you fulfill the mitzvah. So if someone were to ask you, where in the Torah does it say you should do kindness? Where does it say? Where is the mitzvah of doing kindness? Does it say anywhere in the Torah, you shall be kind, you shall do kindness? It doesn't say that in the Torah, specifically. But it says, v'avtarecha kamecha, love your friend as yourself. That is the fulfillment, at least one source of fulfillment, that is the mitzvah of doing acts of kindness. There's another mitzvah that says we're supposed to emulate God. That's another point. When you're just as Hashem, God created the world to be kind with his creations, when we do so, we're emulating him. So you've got two possible mitzvahs of the Torah that you'll fulfill when you do an act of chesed. But when you do an act of kindness to someone, you have done the mitzvah of love your friend as yourself. Okay, negating the mitzvah. One who does something to his friend that he himself would not have wanted done to him is in violation of abnegating this mitzvah. Indeed, even if you personally do not care if this embarrassment was done to you, it is still forbidden to embarrass others in this manner. Okay, so how do you go against this mitzvah, right? If I hurt you, right, then I'm not loving you as I'm not loving you as myself. I don't want to be hurt, right? If I don't want to be hurt, then I shouldn't want to hurt others. If I do hurt someone else, that means I'm not loving him like myself. Now, how about if you're a little bit of a wise guy and you say, if somebody did that to me, I wouldn't care. So, maybe then I shouldn't, if I don't care about it, right, then it doesn't matter if I do it to somebody else. You're telling me, don't do to others what you don't want to yourself. Do it to me, I don't care. That doesn't work, doesn't help. The bottom line is that measure of saying don't to others what you wouldn't do to yourself means seeing yourself in the other person's shoes. It's not just measured by yourself. It's measured by, basically, if you are that person, if you were that person, you wouldn't be done to you, don't do it to him. Okay, next. Joining in his joy and pain. One must rejoice in the good turns of other members of Klal Yisrael as well as participate in their sorrow. Therefore, if one hears that there is a simcha of an individual, a person has a joyous occasion, one must make it one's business to be happy in his joy. When a friend has a tragedy, God forbid, one must share his pain with him. Meaning, here again, a person who is, if you have a joyous occasion, right, and you have no one to celebrate with or to share it with, that's a bummer, right? That's a bummer. If you can't go out and someone else share your joy, that's tough. And the same way, if you're suffering, as we said, right, and there's no one there to comfort you, there's no one there to pick you up, to lift you up, that's very painful. And therefore, if somebody else rejoices, you should rejoice with them. If someone else is suffering, do something to help them alleviate it. Next, helping and praying for others. There is an obligation to help others in all that one can. One must also daven for them to save them from their pain. One who requests mercy on his friend in front of him does not need to mention his friend's name. When it is done not in the presence of his friend, he must mention his name. Okay, what that means is that when we're talking about helping others, one should always remember that one of the greatest ways of helping someone else is to pray for them. So daven for them. Not just to actually do something for them, but to pray for them, to pray on their behalf. When you pray on someone's behalf, that is the greatest form of helping that person. Now, we know one form of doing that is, let's say, a mishaberach, right? Make a prayer for someone who's sick. When you make a prayer for someone who's sick, we make sure to mention their name. What he's saying here from the Chafetz Chaim is that if, let's say, you're in front of the person, you don't necessarily have to say their name. You can pray for them and say, God should bless you, God should heal you. If they're not there, then the way you should be saying it is, you should be saying their name, because I guess in some ways that's what focuses the prayer on them. Okay, another example, advising others. A person is also obligated to think thoughts of advice that one can give to his friend. These thoughts should be useful and effective. Indeed, this is one of the methods of performing gebulas chasadim, acts of kindness. If he provides him with untenable advice, he is in violation of placing a stumbling block before the blind. Okay, advice, again, is a very important act of kindness. Give a person some advice. Give him good ideas. Try to think of ideas how to help a person. A person needs a job. A person needs to get married. Whatever it may be. If you think of advice of how to help the person, that's another form of kindness. Now, what happens if you give a guy bad advice? Okay? Now, and we don't mean like, you know, you meant to say good and it didn't work out. You know, you're giving them bad advice. So clearly you're not helping them. But not only that, there are opinions that say when the Torah mentions a prohibition, the Torah says, before a blind person, not put a stumbling block. Literally translated would mean, if somebody blind's walking by, don't be a jerk and stick out your foot and let the person trip, right? That would be the simplest explanation of that verse, okay? But the commentaries say the Torah doesn't only mean it in its literal sense. It means it in the sense of the blind person means the person who is unaware. And putting a stumbling block means hurting a person who's unaware. So one of the forms of doing that is giving a person bad advice, right? Person comes to ask you about a certain business deal, right? And you give him what he thinks the best advice in the world, but it's not because you're trying to better yourself at his cost. That would be the prohibition of putting a stumbling block before the blind. The person is unaware, you're giving them bad advice, and they're unaware of it. That's putting a stumbling block in front of a blind person. So therefore, giving advice is clearly a fulfillment of the mitzvah of loving your friend as yourself, and bad advice could actually be a transgression of a Torah prohibition. Okay, next. Speaking positively of others. One must also speak positively about other members of Klal Yisrael. Okay? However, in front of someone who has a dislike for the person, we may not sing his praises because it may lead to negative speech about that person. Indeed, even if the positive remarks are not actually said in front of an enemy, but there are such people that are present there, it is also prudent to speak positively on him. Others say that even in front of his loved ones, one should not overpraise him because an account of his praise and negative speech may ensue. Okay, so again, another part of, you would never want someone to speak badly about you. Don't speak badly about others. Now, you may say, okay, so if I say positive things, I should always be okay, right? No, because if you say positive things about a person in front of someone else who dislikes him, all you're going to do is get that person to start speaking badly about the other person. Oh, you think you're such a good guy? Let me tell you about him. Or if, let's say, it's not the person who's his enemy dislikes him, but the kind of people who you know, you say something positive about someone, they feel the responsibility to counter. Then the Chafetz Chaim also writes that there are those who say that even if you're in front of a friendly crowd, right, in front of a crowd that is friendly to the person, if you overdo the praise, you're going to get somebody, you're going to annoy someone, and they're going to say something negative. You know, it's just the human nature that there's a certain point that when you start like, you know, putting on too much, they kind of get like, all right, this is enough, and they actually react to try to counter that in some way. So therefore, as much as it's important to speak positively of others, and we know if you don't speak positively, that actually is the prohibition of what we call lashon hara, evil speech. But again, clearly, if you would want others to speak positively about you, you should speak positively about others. But even there, by speaking positively about others, you got to be careful. Okay. Now, another example, another important thing he mentions is limitations of positive speech. Even though there is a mitzvah to speak positively of others, it is forbidden to incorrectly state that the person is very wise and one can completely rely upon him if the truth is that that's not the case. You know, I want to speak positively about someone. So somebody asks me, you know, I want to hire this person as a teacher, right? I want to hire him as a math teacher. Does he know math? So you know he does it. He's terrible at math, but I don't want to speak bad about the person, right? Supposed to speak positive about the person. So there, of course, the Chavetz Chaim says there's no issue with speaking positive about the person. Why? Since it may cause damage to others if they rely upon his advice and statements. Okay? One may also not state that another person is an honest person who can be relied upon if he does not necessarily know that it's true. You want to know, I want to entrust this person with someone. Is he honest? Right? If you don't know, or you know that he's not necessarily honest, there is a situation you can't say something positive. You're not allowed to say something positive that's not true, because you're hurting the other person. If, let's say, it's not relevant to anything, you know, is this guy a nice guy? Is that relevant to anything, right? So say he's a nice guy. Yeah? Speak positive. It's not going to cause any hurt to anybody else. Okay. Opportunity to teach others. When the opportunity is presented to an individual to teach Torah to fellow Jews, even if they are children, and it's not possible that this be done through others, there is an obligation to teach them. Even if through this the person will miss out on his own deeper Torah learning, this is true like any other mitzvah. So again, here's an example. But this is really an example that relates in many cases. If a person finds themselves in a situation, they're studying Torah. Someone else needs something. So it's a question of stopping your Torah study to help the other person. What do you do? So the Shulchan Aruch says that it depends. If someone else can do it, then don't interrupt your Torah study. If someone else can't do it, then you have to interrupt. So that really applies to anything, even though, again, it means you're interrupting your Torah study. You're losing out on your Torah study. And that includes any mitzvah, and especially true when it comes to teaching Torah. Because the obligation that we have to study Torah is not just to study Torah, but it's also to teach. At the same time, there may be a certain situation where a person, again, finds themselves in a situation where it's my Torah study or to teach someone else. Okay? And he's not at the point of, and he's at a point of life that he's studying. He's not yet ready to necessarily teach. He's still studying. But again, there's no one else to teach. If there's no one else to teach, then he's got to stop to teach. Okay. Now here's an interesting thing to have in mind: the mitzvah. We've been mentioning now a number of examples of how a person can fulfill the mitzvah of loving your friend as yourself. So the next paragraph is like this: regarding the mitzvah of loving your friend as yourself, and like in other mitzvahs that are between man and his friend, one should have in mind when doing the favor to his friend that he's doing so for the sake of a mitzvah. For it has been established that mitzvahs require intent. However, if this was not done, it does not negate the mitzvah like in other mitzvahs. Since the other party is benefiting from it, it does not negate the mitzvah like in other mitzvahs. Since the other party is benefiting from it, the mitzvah still counts. That means it's like this. There is a concept of, actually it's an argument, whether mitzvahs tzriches kavana. That means, do I need intent to do a mitzvah for the mitzvah to count? So for instance, just an example. If let's say I was studying Torah through the night, okay, and I happen to be in the part of the Torah of Shema, and the morning comes and it's time to do the mitzvah of Shema, and I happen to be reading that part of the Torah, okay, and I just read. I read it like I'm reading anything else, but it happened to be in Shema, and it was the morning and I had the mitzvah of reading Shema. Did I get the mitzvah or not? I had no intent to do the mitzvah. Mm. I didn't have intent to do it. But I did it. So does a mitzvah count if I did a mitzvah, but I didn't intend to do it? So actually, it's an argument amongst the early halakhic authorities. And there are those who say, without intent, you can't fulfill the mitzvah. You don't get the mitzvah. It doesn't count if you don't have intent. When it comes to there, I can't remember how the Shulchan Aruch says. I think it comes for practically speaking, you're supposed to have in mind, anytime you do a mitzvah, that my intent is to fulfill the mitzvah. If you don't have that intent, the mitzvah, I believe, typically still does count, but because of the opinions who say it doesn't count, you should have it in mind. What he's saying here is, therefore, if I'm about to do a kindness to someone, now clearly, you do a kindness, you know, you want to do what feeling could care for the person, but you're doing a mitzvah too. And if I'm doing a mitzvah, then I should have intent, I should have in mind, I am about to fulfill the mitzvah of love your friend as yourself. So, like any other time you do a mitzvah, you should have intent that you're doing a mitzvah. What he adds here is that at the end of the day, if let's say I didn't have the intention, it would still count, if I understand correctly what he's saying according to all opinions, because at the end of the day, the point of the mitzvah is to benefit that person, and you benefited him. And therefore, at the end of the day, the mitzvah is going to count, whether you intended or not, because that's the point of the mitzvah. But again, what he's trying to say is that a person should, when they're about to fulfill this mitzvah of love your friend as yourself, with the kindness they're going to do, they should have intent, they should have in mind that they're fulfilling the mitzvah of love your friend as yourself. Now, next paragraph, not to lose out on income. A person is not obligated to lose out on his income in order to perform work for others. For Rabbi Akiva has already come and taught, Chayecha koidim l'chayi chaverecha, your life takes precedence to that of your friend. From here we learn that there is no obligation to love one's friend to the exact same extent as one loves oneself, since the nature of a human being is not ready to accept such a thing. What that means is like this. If I had to really love my friend as myself, then basically, if it's a question of making a living or helping that person, what should I be doing? Well, if I have to love him exactly like myself,
it would be 50-50.
It could be 50, he could be stuck. Like, what do I do then?
Yeah.
Right? But the bottom line is that we also have a principle that chayecha kaidman, your life precedes your friend's life. Which means that, you know, if you got to take care of your life, such as making a living, that's what you got to do. And you don't say, well, I won't make a living in order to help someone else out. You're not obligated to do that. And therefore, as important as it is to help others, it doesn't override your ability to make a livelihood for yourself. At the same time, a person can sometimes think that if, you know, my livelihood is well taken care of, it's a question of making more money, then maybe then it would be worthwhile, if possible, to take out the time to help someone else. But you don't have to lose out on your income in order to perform the mitzvah of loving your friend as yourself. Now, this next paragraph is not so easy to understand, but but it's an important thing to know about. Who does not apply to? Is there such a thing, a person that you don't have to love? Is there such a thing? So the mitzvah of after l'reyacha kamayicha, love your friend as yourself, applies specifically to one is re'acha. That's the wording. Re'acha means your friend, your peer. A peer in Torah and mitzvahs. However, if the person is evil, that is, he sees that he violates a well-known sin as being forbidden, and does not accept rebuke, it is a mitzvah to dislike him. That means like this. Now this is not something that is necessarily that very common. A person who does not perform Torah mitzvahs, just the mere fact that he's not performing Torah mitzvahs doesn't make him a Rasha. Doesn't make him someone evil. If a person is ignorant, if a person never really was raised or taught to understand the importance of Torah mitzvahs, you know, that does not make them evil, a Rasha. That doesn't take them out of the status of Re'acha, your peer, or your friend. But let's say you have a person who you know very well that this person knows exactly what they're doing is wrong. And they're doing it anyway. and you rebuke them, and they're not interested in taking the rebuke, that person falls out of the status of Re'achar, your friend. That's not necessarily the most common case in the world. But it's a person, a situation where, again, the person is intentionally going, it's not uncommon. It happens. It happens. Mm-hmm. And again, when you see such a thing, you have to judge it and figure out exactly all the factors involved in this person's life. But again, if you could have a person that is doing a sin intentionally, they know it's wrong, they're doing it anyway, you rebuke them, they couldn't care less, that person falls out of Re'acha. That person is no more your friend, no more your peer. The mitzvah of loving your friend as yourself does not apply to that person. Now, the next paragraph, even to children. This mitzvah even applies to children. That means like this. That means at the end of the day, even if children are less than bar mitzvah age, right? So they're not an adult Jew, right? Mm-hmm. They don't have an obligation to do mitzvahs, right? There are certain mitzvahs that don't necessarily apply to a child, to doing with a child. The haftal re'acha kamayich, when it comes to love your friend as yourself, includes a child, even someone that's not, so to speak, already obligated in the mitzvahs of the Torah. Includes every Jewish person. It includes even children. Okay, in the final paragraph, he says like this, and this actually comes from the Arizal, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, the famous Kabbalist, and in many Siddurim you'll find this. Before each prayer, a person must accept upon himself to love every member of Klal Yisrael. Before each tefillah, this should be verbalized with the following formula. I hereby accept upon myself the mitzvah of Ahavta L'Re'acha Kamecha. That means before you daven, you accept upon yourself that you love every person as yourself. And when that is what a person accepts upon himself before his tefillah, before his prayer, that helps his prayers be accepted. That helps his prayers be accepted. If the person says to the Rebbeinu Shalaylam, I want to be one with everyone, that is something that creates a stronger ability for one's prayers to be accepted. So this is a nice little short, concise overview of the mitzvah. One last thing I just want to conclude with. So as we mentioned that in the beginning of the class, how the Medrash says that Yaakov told his children, hey, us will gather together when you're united, that is how that's how you ready yourselves for the coming of Mashiach. So there is a story related in the Talmud with a Talmudic sage. His name was Rabbi Bar Chana. And there are a number of stories in the Talmud Baba Basra that occurred to Rabbi Bar Chana that actually, many commentaries say they're not real stories, they're just parables. But the story goes, Rabbi Bar Chana says that he was once traveling on a boat and he landed on an island and he didn't realize that the island was really a giant whale. And he got off the boat, he started walking on the... I said it's a parable. And he's walking on the whale, he thinks he's on an island. So, he figures, it's an island, he wants to eat something. So he brings out some wood and he makes a fire and he starts cooking food, right? And he's making this fire on the whale's back. So the whale got a little bit hot on his back. And the whale turned over, right, to knock everything off his back, which knocked Rabbi Bar Chana into the water. And Rabbi Bar Chana said that if not for the fact that I grabbed onto my boat, I never would have survived. That's the story. Okay? What's the point of the story? So the commentary of the Maharsha explains the point of the story like this. That Rabbi Bar Chana traveling the boat represents the Jewish people in exile. Right? They're on a boat. They're traveling from place to place. They're in exile. And history has it that when the Jewish people are in exile and they travel to another country, they find themselves in a new place, and then they get very settled down. That's represented by the fire and the cooking. They settle down in the new country, and they forget they're in exile. Like, this is home, right? Doesn't read he's on the back of a whale. He thinks he's on an island, piece of ground. Okay? And what happens when they start forgetting about that they're in exile? Mm-hmm. the whale turns over. They get chased out. And just like Rabbi Rav Hanina grabbed onto his boat to survive, it means that that represents the idea when the Jewish people are kicked out of the country, that reminds them that they're still in exile. Reminds them they're not where they're supposed to be until Mashiach comes. And when they're reminded that they're in Golus, they're in exile, that becomes their hope to be able to continue sailing through the ocean of exile to eventually come to the ultimate island of Mashiach, but that only happens when they don't forget that they're in exile.